Thank you, Larry and Janet. Thank you to our kids. This morning, you did a great job. Thank you for helping us celebrate Palm Sunday. It's our first time, my family's first time to experience this, and it was great. We are so thankful for the work that went into it and just to watch all of our kids up front. I think that's one of the favorite things for most churches is to watch kids on the stage. We just enjoy it, don't we? There's an air of unpredictability to it. You just don't know what's going to happen. But really, we just like seeing the joyous kids coming across the stage and laying their palm branches down. And so thank you for that experience and for helping us celebrate Palm Sunday. I'm also thankful to those who have already mentioned our friends in Nashville at the Covenant Church and School, people that we know in different states who've been affected by tornadoes. And so we continue to lift them up in prayer. And we trust that the God of resurrection is doing his Easter work in communities that have experienced death and destruction. And we entrust their care to the God who cares for them more than we'll ever know. In the years right before the birth of Jesus, there's a lot of uneasy alliances that are just sort of keeping the peace, but not really well. A lot of different groups that don't really get along, and at a moment's notice, conflict could erupt. So before Jesus comes on the scene, Caesar Augustus is leading the Roman Empire, and a man named Herod is in charge of the Jews. And these two groups have an uneasy peace. They don't really want to coexist, but they have to. The Roman Empire would be fine if this small group called the Jews would just go away. And the Jews would love nothing more than to get the big, bad Roman Empire off their back. And so we find ourselves at the moment of Jesus' birth with these tensions existing and wondering what will happen. So this man, Herod, finds himself in an interesting spot. Rome doesn't really like him, but they tolerate him because he keeps his people at peace. And the Jews don't really like him because, well, he's certain, first of all, not fully Jewish. They don't trust his lineage. They think he's probably secretly on the take from Rome. You know, if he keeps his people in line, they probably keep him, you know, well-funded. And so they wonder if he's actually ruling them with their best interests at heart, because they think his true allegiance is probably with Rome, and they're probably right. So, we get to this moment of Jesus' birth, and Herod is paranoid. He's looking over his shoulder at every turn, wondering who's coming after him. Rome doesn't like him. His people don't like him. They don't see him as a legitimate king. And then these wise men, these magi, come to Herod, king of the Jews. And they have the audacity to ask the king of the Jews this question: where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We have seen the star when it rose, and we've come to worship him. Now, Herod could respond to this in a number of ways. You know, Herod could say, hey, I don't know if you see the nameplate on my desk or the diplomas on the wall, but we've already got a king of the Jews, and it's me, in case you didn't get that memo, so there's no king of the Jews to go worship. But he doesn't respond quite that way, does he? He responds with deception, with threats, and ultimately with violence against children. This is a man who is deeply paranoid and insecure. What is it about their question, where's the one born king of the Jews, that causes Herod to act this way? What would it mean for them to ask about the king of the Jews? What did Jews want in a king, and why was Herod perhaps not it? As we continue looking through the titles of Jesus, I want to focus today on King, which is entirely appropriate for Palm Sunday. So the Jews, as they talked about king, had a rich history of this word. Back in Genesis, there are chapters that list king after king of other nations. Pharaoh is called the king of Egypt. The king that we might be most familiar with in the Old Testament is David. But he wasn't the first. There was King Saul before him. They wanted a king like all the other nations, and God kept saying, it's not going to work out for you. It's not going to work out for you. You don't want a king. He said, give us a king, and they got some. Some of them were good, some not, but Saul was the first official king, although they'd been trying to make people king before that. And even a judge, so this is the time before the kings, a judge named Gideon, they want to make him king. And he says, no, 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 I can't be king. And they said, no, we want to make you our king. And he says, no, no, I can't be king, but, you know, go ahead and give me your gold. But no, I can't be king, but go ahead and give me this stuff. And then Gideon proceeds to name his son Abimelech. I don't know if you know what that means, but Avi means my daddy, and Melech is king. So it's interesting to say, I don't want to be king, and you name your son my daddy is king. A rich history of kingship, both good and bad. David was the king they remember, a man who on the one hand was after God's own heart, and on the other hand committed unspeakable crimes against people. But after David, things sort of fell apart. His son Solomon's on the throne, and then the kingdom splits in its conflict and strife, and some good kings and some bad kings. And the people of Israel are wondering, are we ever going to have a real king again who will bring things back to the way we knew them? And so they started having prophecies about the coming king. And I want to read you some of those prophecies that they would have been familiar with. They would have been familiar with this verse from Zechariah that we read on Palm Sunday. See, your king comes to you, righteous and victorious, lowly and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. And they would have wondered what kind of king would do that, but they knew there was a king coming. Or they would have known verses back in 2 Samuel when God is talking to David and he says, the Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you. When your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Now, a few weeks ago, we were reminded that this isn't immediately about Jesus, because the next verse says, when he does wrong, I will punish him. But God is promising to David that someone from your lineage will be on the throne, and your kingdom will be established forever. So the people of Israel around the time of Jesus had expectations for what a king would be like. And this is it. If you ask them, what is a king? They would say, well, it is an expected righteous ruler from David's line who will restore us to our former glory. That's what they thought a king was. Now, what about their friends in the Roman Empire? I say friends. I guess that's not the appropriate term. What would the people in the Roman Empire have thought about the word king? They had opinions about it, because Luke tells us in the book of Acts that there were people who were defying Caesar's decrees, saying that there is another king, one called Jesus. So Caesar apparently had some decrees about who you could call king. You might guess the one you can call king is Caesar, probably no one else. So they were defying those decrees. But more than the phrase or the word king, Rome had an idea about how a king should come into town victorious. Because they were used to this. What Jesus did wasn't entirely new. It was different, but it wasn't new. They had triumphs. That's what they called them. When the emperor or the king would come back into town victorious, ride in on a chariot, be accompanied by soldiers and even prisoners of war to humiliate those whom they had defeated. And then they'd gather and have a huge feast, and the general or the king, whoever, would receive a lot of awards and a lot of praise. One example is in the year 46 BC, Julius Caesar gets four of these triumphs within a very short period of time. So he comes into town. These would be like 4 days long. You'd have chariots pulled by white horses. He's wearing a purple toga with gold embroidery. And all the soldiers would come in and the conquered king, so they could humiliate this person through the streets of town. That's how you come back into town as a triumphant king. So if you ask Romans, what is a triumphant king like? They would say, it's a conquering ruler with absolute power who has celebrated lavishly. They knew what it looks like when a king comes into town victorious. But we have Jesus coming into town gently on a donkey, which is an obvious contrast to what they would have thought a king should do when he comes into town. You could even say that Jesus is deliberately subverting or maybe even parodying what they would have expected. There are a couple of examples I want to give you that might help us in our society understand how different this was. Now, one is going to betray my love of comedy and late night shows, okay? So in 1981, NBC is looking for a show to follow the beloved Johnny Carson Tonight Show. And they're trying to figure out what they could do later at night to appeal to a different crowd. And they want a show that is similar but doesn't exactly mimic the Tonight Show. And so they're thinking, well, we need to do some things differently. We're going to have a lower budget. And they find this guy, David Letterman. Now, he had a morning show, didn't quite work out. Maybe his brand of humor will work at night. And he does his show differently on purpose. He embraces the difference. So they say, Mr. Letterman, Johnny Carson, he's got a very well-scripted and crafted monologue. We really don't want you to have a monologue. And so he just riffs for a few minutes and calls it opening remarks and takes pains to show how underprepared he is. Or, you know, Johnny Carson's got a nice big orchestra. We don't want to pay for that. We don't want you to have that. And he says, okay, I'll have a band that looks like they walked out of somebody's garage practicing. A little four-piece band to start. And, you know, this big Tonight Show, they've got well-scripted bits, perfectly written. And Letterman says, you know what, I'll put on a suit of Alka-Seltzer and jump in some water. Or I'll drop things off a building and see how they explode. He's taking this format people are used to and deliberately doing it differently to say, I'm different. Now, here's the other example that might hit closer to home here. Okay, can I just tell you that everybody's talking about artificial intelligence and how that's going to take all our jobs and then kill us, right? But right now we're wondering, how does that affect our work? And so it's not writing my sermons yet, I promise you. But I wanted to craft an image. There was an image that didn't exist, and I wanted to show it. And what I thought was, what would it look like for a football team to come back into town after winning the Super Bowl with the victory parade they sometimes have through one of the streets? But what if the cars they were driving were not very, shall we say, classy? So I need to tell you before I show you this image that it's interesting that AI can get a lot of interesting details that you don't even tell it. It's not great at faces yet, okay? So just understand that. That's going to be odd. But I said, what if the Dallas Cowboys had a Super Bowl parade through downtown Dallas, but they were driving rusted convertibles? Okay, you ready? Here's what we got. Like, that's an image that doesn't exist. That's not Photoshop. That's just generated from scratch. So here's what I love. Like, without me telling it, it put a blue star on the side of one of the convertibles. It can get that right. Not quite the faces. They're a little blocky. That's what it would be like. The victorious team comes into town, but instead of riding nice new cars through the streets, they're in rusted out convertibles. That's what Jesus does to turn these expectations on their head. He comes in riding on a donkey, and he says, I'm going to do it differently. N.T. Wright had this to say, he was not the king they expected. He wasn't like the monarchs of old who sat in their jeweled and ivory thrones, dispensing their justice and wisdom. Nor was he the great warrior king some had wanted. He didn't raise an army and ride into battle at its head. He was riding on a donkey, and he was weeping. Weeping for the dream that had to die, weeping for the sword that would pierce his supporters to the soul, weeping for the kingdom that wasn't coming, as well as for the kingdom that was. He was king, all right, but he had come to redefine kingship itself around his own work, his own mission, his own fate. If Jesus is indeed the king, all right, what's different for us? The first thing that's different is that we redefine power. That verse we read from Zechariah about riding in gently on a donkey, do you know what comes next? The very next verse about the king. Zechariah 9:10. I will take away the chariots from Ephraim and the war horses from Jerusalem, and the battle bow will be broken. He will proclaim peace to the nations. His rule will extend from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. All the military buildup they could have is of no use under the rule of the real king. All the chariots, all the war horses, all the nuclear armaments are useless in the reign of the king, because he comes to redefine what power is like. And it's not intimidation. It's not peace through strength. It is this disarmament that says a new king is in charge who has come to bring peace. So all the definitions of power that we want to have get turned on their head under the reign of King Jesus. So that's the first thing. We redefine power. And secondly, we rethink our loyalties. I don't know when we want to say that political season begins again. I sometimes think it's just all the time now, but it's going to ramp up sooner than most of us want. And if you talk to any ministers, we'd all say we'd give real money to just go hibernate until it's over. Some of you would too. It's difficult. And our loyalties get tested. And one thing I've seen during these tense seasons is people will post this phrase, well, you know, we just got to remember that Jesus is king. So on the one hand, yes, thank you, amen. On the second hand, I tend to see that from someone whose person didn't win, and this is sort of their consolation prize. In other words, they don't say that when their person wins. Jesus is king is not our consolation prize. It's not something we only affirm when we didn't get our way. Well, it's good to know, even though this knucklehead I didn't want in power, at least Jesus is king. I'm glad you're saying that versus some other things you might be saying, for sure. But let's affirm that Jesus is king, and that's our highest and best loyalty, not to some person, not to some party, that King Jesus deserves our ultimate allegiance. If you want to know what a true king looks like, and if you want to know what a true king will endure, Matthew tells us this in the scene of the crucifixion of Jesus. Here's how Matthew leads us to the cross. They, these are the guards, stripped Jesus and put a scarlet robe on him, and then they twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on his head. They put a staff in his right hand. Then they knelt in front of him and mocked him. Hail, King of the Jews, they said. They spit on him. And they took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. And above his head, they placed a written charge. And it said, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." What they said mockingly, we affirm wholeheartedly. wholeheartedly that Jesus is King. Let's be standing as we sing.